Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Cinephiles Radio. I'm your host, Steve Pisa. I see we have a big audience today. Thank you so much for joining us today at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, always. Now, how was your week? I always say that every week. I want to know how was your week. You want to call in, you can call in at 515-602-9609. How was your week? I went to Chicago. I went to Second City. I had a great time. Ate a lot of great food. It was funny. On the way there, there was a Lyft driver. He just started talking so much malarkey about the food in Chicago. And the person I was with and the person I was going with was right next to me. And they were just steaming at the top. I've got to tell you, the food in Chicago is just simply wonderful. I mean, it's not any different than any other big city. It's a wonderful food, great chefs, great ingredients, fresh ingredients. I loved it. The architecture in Chicago is amazing. Simply amazing. A Gothic is putting a limitation almost on how you would explain some of the architecture in Chicago. It's just majestic. I mean, I've been to Florence, I've been to Rome, I've been across Europe, but I've seen a lot of amazing things. But, you know, other than New York, this has got to be some of the most wonderful architecture I've seen in America, without a doubt. And the food was great. Second City was fantastic as well. If you ever go to Second City, it's an old town over there in Chicago. And I recommend to you that you do not order the food. The fries were freezing. I don't know what I was thinking. I was just so starving. And it's funny. My guest wanted me to have a beer. And I did not want to have a beer. I have this funny mentality that I think it's quite rude to drink at a comedy session because you're more apt to laugh at things that are not funny and not be completely honest because you're a bit, you know, abbreviated from what you were before. So I'm not a gigantic fan of that, but I had a fantastic time. Wow. Anyways, our previous guest, Hal Rudnick, just posed a question recently about the Joker movie, and I wanted to respond to that out of all due respect. And I love your argument, and he did want to ask that specific question, what did we think? Did this Joker have the ability to be a mastermind in the Batman universe? So that is the question that he asked. I would say no. That this Joker is not that Joker. This Joker is not that mastermind Joker. This Joker is not that get people to pin against each other and use psychological warfare to destroy your opponent. This is basically how the Joker was created with his bad narration of how he began or what his beginning episodes of being the Joker were. See, his inconsistency with what his origin story is what makes him so incredible as a character. And this is probably one perspective, only one perspective of what the Joker's life really was or what he perceives life as. And it gives us an insight into this character. I would say that's what this movie does. It's certainly not the Christopher Nolan Joker. I would say that Joker is more familiar to us. I don't know what the real Joker is. I think that is one of his great things. Is he's like almost he's almost like Hitler, where it's like you really don't know how evil this human being is based on, you know, there's no way to almost bring it into some kind of like psychological realm of understanding. It's just horrible. Anyways, that was my opinion. Anyways, we have the great Anthony Montez on today. He's not only a writer, he's a novelist, he's a director, he's a producer. I mean, he does it all. And we bring him on today. We have a big audience today. Hey, Anthony Montes, how you doing, my friend?
How you doing, Steve? I'm okay.
Good, good. Listen, so you're an actor, you're a writer, you're a novelist, you're a director. You do it all. Tell us, how did it all begin? Where did you get the notion that you wanted to be an artist?
It wasn't really a conscious thought. I mean, I knew at five from watching movies and on TV and then movies with my grandfather that that's where I wanted to be. I wanted to be up on that screen. I think initially I wanted a different reality than I had, and the movies were a great escape. And I would act out characters that I'd seen with my brothers and sisters, and sometimes I would stay in these characters. I would just be them. The Man from U.N.C.L.E., I loved comedy. I loved Abbott and Costello, Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin.
Right, the originals.
And yeah, and then when I got a little older, I liked the films of Marlon Brando and Montgomery Clift and James Dean. And then as I got in, to be a teenager, I discovered Pacino and De Niro and Dustin Hoffman, and I knew that's what I wanted to do. So I would read everything on those guys, and I would study what they studied. And
no, was it
craft.
Was it advantageous at your age, as a young man, to be desiring to be an actor? I mean, it is a completely different generation than a lot of the maybe opposed younger people that are listening to right now, that it definitely was a time that if you told somebody you wanted to be an actor, they probably would either laugh at you or ask you to get a second occupation.
Yeah. It was definitely not encouraged. I mean, when I told my father I wanted to be an actor, he thought it was because I didn't want to work. And he thought it was he was very masculine thing to do, to be an actor.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So he had no idea how much work would be involved in the pursuit of this career.
Oh yeah. The cerebral work you guys do is really immense. I saw your one man show, and I want to talk to you about that a little bit later on, so we can go into some really nice stories about your past. It really fleshes you out. Really, really great as a human being. I love your one-man show myself, but I really want to talk about The Last Train, because I really loved that film myself. It was, please tell us about that film.
What's the premise? It came about on the 4th of July, 1983. I'd been, I'd suffered with depression, and I was working three jobs just to live in New York and study what I wanted to study.
Right.
Let me just turn this off. Sorry.
You must be the only person in the planet Earth that has this old of.
I know. It's my mother calling. Yeah. Yeah. Who was a great woman, by the way. But I suffered from depression, and I had enough, and I had a horrible relationship with my father. And
yeah.
I tried to take my life by jumping in front of a train. And then it was my father's voice in my head that put me on the tracks. And as soon as I hit the tracks, I thought of my mom, and I jumped to the side. It was the elevated train in New York, and the train just came by and clipped me, fractured my arm.
So you literally had the devil angel on either side of your shoulder at that time.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
As soon as I hit the tracks, I thought, oh, my God, I can't do this to my mother. And
yeah,
that's what, it wasn't even that I wanted to live. It was, I can't do this to my mom.
Right.
And it became difficult for me living in New York. I couldn't even see the trains anymore. So I ended up moving to Los Angeles and pursuing my career out here. So it's many years later, I know how fortunate I am to be talking to you now.
Yeah.
I toyed with the idea of telling my story, but not exactly my story. Telling a story, I wanted it to be a story about hope. And I came up with this premise that what would have happened if I was getting ready to jump and somebody else was getting ready to jump at the same time. And I worked with this wonderful, wonderful actress, Sierra Danielle.
Yes.
I wrote it as a play first, and we put it on stage, and it was really well received on stage.
Hmm.
And I had written it like a screenplay. I had 17 set changes in the play. And then from that, we did a Kickstarter campaign, and we found some people to invest the money in and made it into a feature film.
That's nice. You know, what was surprising about the film when I went to go see it at first, you know, myself, you know, suffering from some episodes of not necessarily wanting to kill myself, but not necessarily wanting to be alive myself. You know, it was intriguing to watch a film that hit a subject that was so close to home, but had comedy to it and had a levity to it that allowed somebody for it to be digestible. I think that's the thing I told you when I first saw it was this was an easily digestible film. Tell me, did you work hard at that?
Well, I inflict humor in everything that I do. I mean, I like to laugh. I like to make people laugh, even with my teaching. But I thought I was writing a drama. It wasn't until a reviewer came and reviewed it as a romantic comedy.
Right.
and I think I knew the situation would be funny. I knew there would be some, you know, I would take some shots at myself from her point of view that I thought would be humorous. But when I'm writing, I just kind of tell the story. I don't set out to write a drama or a comedy or, you know, I just let it become whatever it is. But when I was done with it, I did think it was a drama because of the subject matter. And I was pleasantly surprised by the how much people enjoyed it and had fun with it and got something out of it.
Oh, absolutely. I think everybody got something out of it. I see it twice with two different audiences, and they very much loved it and enjoyed it and didn't really know exactly what to take away from it immediately, which is what you want from a lot of films. You want people to contemplate and think about what they just saw and what have you. Now, let's go back to your one-man show that you put on. What was the name of the one-man show you put on for? It was James Franco's Theater, was it not? In Studio?
Yes. Yeah, it was Studio 4. I had taught for James, so they let me use the theater to put up my one-man show, Out of the Darkness into the Light.
Out of the Darkness into the Light. Was that an exercise in Meisner, was it not?
Well, no. It was just
okay.
How I felt about life.
Right.
How I had felt my life had gone. I had felt I had come out of the darkness into the light.
Right.
And I wanted to share that it felt like people who know me now would not recognize me when I was younger. People who knew me then wouldn't recognize me now. And that change is possible if you want to.
What was amazing was that the show involved the audience as well, who can go up and at turn by turn, maybe four people actually per episode, and pick out a clipping, right, and ask a part of a story.
Yeah, and I have on stage with me, I have a bingo wheel, and they spin it, and there's 84 tablets, and each one has a chapter from some event in my life, from the worst of me to the best of me. So I have no idea what's coming out.
So things could be taken out of context really easy. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the first time I did it, it was just like one bad story after another. And the whole premise is that I tried to kill myself by jumping in front of a train, and I'm in this otherworldly place, and I have 263 pictures. You see my life pass in front of me from the age I am now to an infant.
Right.
And then the lights come up, and a voice out of the darkness asks me why. I say, excuse me? And the voice says, why? I say, oh, this, I was just running for the train and I slipped and I get zapped by this electric current. So I know I can't lie to this entity. Then
right.
the lights come up on the audience and I ask who they are and the voice says, they're the deciders. And I say, decide what? If I go to heaven? And it cuts me off. This tells me there's no hell. And it's explained to me that we have three lifetimes to come here to learn the lessons we've come to learn. And if we've learned them, then we pass on to something better. And if not, we become a decider, which is a nice existence.
Right.
But now because I tried to take my life, they are like my jury. And I need to explain why I did the things I did in my life. And at the end, they vote if I go back to Earth to complete my journey or if I become a decider like them.
Yeah. Now, what I noticed immediately from a lot of your work is that you do believe in symbolism a great deal, and you do put it everywhere, especially the sunflower and what have you. So, how much of you know, and knowing a lot of your stories as well, how much do you believe that symbolism has to do with your artwork, and how much do you try to integrate it as well into your artwork?
Well, it's a daisy. And it were meaningful in my life because my grandfather, I don't know, whenever I've come to a point in my life where I feel like, oh, I got a handle on this or I got an idea of what this life's about, I feel an obligation to share it.
Right.
So I put it in everything. In the beginning, it was just for myself. You know, I would put a character's name, Daisy. So I would hear it, and it would be like I was taking my grandfather on stage with me, or, you know, so I never felt like I was alone doing this.
Right.
And it gave me a chance to share it with them, I felt. And I always felt their presence always, and whenever I've needed them, well, my grandfather particularly, these daisies would come into my life. So, and I've had... signs from other people who have passed on that through things that I would recognize let me know that they're still around me.
Right.
So it's wonderful for me to be able to share these stories. I never know which stories are going to come out, but sometimes the story about the daisies will come out, or a beautiful story about my friend David comes out, who had taken his life. And
right.
And it always bothered me because growing up Catholic, not that I'm a practicing Catholic, but I'm spiritual.
Well, once a Catholic, always a Catholic. We both know that.
The part that bothered me was my friend David had taken his life, and
right.
I know how much pain someone else is
right.
in at that point in their life, and it didn't register with me that this all loving God would punish somebody who's already suffering by sending them to limbo or to hell. And I was on my way to David's funeral, and I said, David, just let me know you're okay as I'm driving. And this moving van is past my right side, just as I'm talking to him. And I didn't notice it at first, but then it gets in front of me, and it's Knight moving, and David's last name was Knight. So it's like, all right, I know you're
right.
okay. And then
the
I
actor David
his
Knight.
Other stories with David as well. He was an actor. I don't think he had very many credits. He
right.
was, he had come out here actually with Matt LeBlanc. They were good friends, and of course Matt's career went the way it did, and David
right.
struggled. But he was part of my classes. Twice a week, he never missed a class in the almost 4 years he was with me ever. So,
you know, Anthony, if you can give me a second, let me just put this out there for my audience, because I like to, you know, when we have serious episodes like this, and we do have another show called Forgotten People that we do talk about deep things just like this, but we do have a National Suicide Prevention and Lifeline hotline, which is 1-800-273-8255. Again, 1-800-273-8255. If you have any thoughts of suicide, just, give them a call. They'll be ready to listen to you. Anthony, tell me more about Mr. Knight.
He was, you know, just the day that he was turning 30, and he hung around that Saturday after class, and I knew there was going to be a birthday party for him. And he hung around, and I knew something was on his mind. I said, "What's going on?" And he said, "You know, it's my birthday." I said, "Oh," I acted like I didn't know. "Happy birthday." He said, "Yeah, I'm turning 30. I thought I'd be further along by now." And I was older than David, and I told him that I thought 30 was a great age for
yeah.
me. And I tried to be encouraging, but not thinking, not even knowing. He always wore a brave face, so I had no idea that he suffered from depression. That night at his party, when we said goodbye, it didn't register. When he said goodbye to me, he hugged me a little bit longer, and there was a look in his eyes that I knew it meant something, but I didn't know what was going on. And then 3 days later, he had taken his life by shooting himself.
That's incredible.
I'd just like to share one more story with him, because it was years later. So it wasn't just when I was going to his funeral. You know, I remember David daily. I do a morning letter to myself. And
really?
I draw daisies for people. Yeah. I draw daisies for people who have passed on. And I have, unfortunately, 6 people that I know that have taken their own lives. And because of my one-man show and because of my film, The Last Train, there are 6 people that when they're walking the razor's edge, they contact me. So I ask those that have taken their lives to watch over those that are still here.
Right.
And maybe 3 years after David had passed away, I'm driving down Sherman Way, and I'm stopped at a light by Venice Airport, and I see these people looking at a plane. And I'm talking to David in my head, and I said, "Oh, that'd be so cool. It must be so cool to go up in a little plane like that." That afternoon, I got a call from a friend of mine. He said, "Tony, I have this industrial film I'm supposed to shoot on Monday. I can't do it. I had a picture and resume of yours. I gave it to them. Without even meeting you, they're ready to hire you if you could do it on Monday. The thing is, you can't be afraid to go up in a small plane." Not only is that, Monday was my birthday. So I'm talking to David about how cool it would be to go up in one of these planes. On my birthday, I go up in one of these planes. I get paid to go up in one of these planes. And when I'm up there, the pilot says, "Would you like to fly it?" And he lets me fly it for a little bit.
Right.
So, David, and I was feeling depressed around the time. David, and I know it was a birthday gift from him from beyond.
Yeah.
So.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So, so how long ago was that today when he committed suicide?
My God, it was in the 80s.
Wow.
80s.
The 80s, pre-YouTube, pre-Instagram.
Must be the 90s now. He's got to be gone 20 years at least.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
You know, I would
have maybe 25. Time, it's like, I judge it by pre-Matthew and post-Matthew. So Matthew's my son.
Matthew, your son,
19 on Wednesday. Yeah.
That's how a lot of fathers do things. Like pre-Matthew, post-Matthew. I think that's how we got AD, BC. Yeah. We have from a favorite son.
yes.
So your family, you know, your family's always been hardcore Catholic, and your mother's a great woman.
Yeah.
And what is your mother's name? Share that with our audience.
Yeah, Audrey. Audrey.
And now you talk about her a lot inside your one man show, which was incredible. You know, you share a lot of stories with her and about your grandfather and about your father.
Yeah.
I would like you to share one story with us about your father inside the bar. Cause you know, that is quite a perplexing story. Cause not a lot of people, I think a lot of people have stories that are like that, but I don't think a lot of people can articulate it quite the way you can. So when we talk about like demonstrative fathers or what have you, what was your father like when you were young?
Well, my father was a very angry man. He was alcoholic, very bitter. I you know, I don't know what his ambitions were. I know he was a great mechanic and he was great.
But that would be my
hand.
Question is because when I saw your one man show, I'm like, what was this guy's ambitions that he did not achieve that made him this angry?
You know, he would blame my mother. He wanted to be a postal inspector. I don't know what happened there. She wasn't for it. But he was always looking for someone to blame.
Right.
The thing is,
right.
he was a really, really intelligent man, self-taught, everything he did.
Wow.
In order to forgive him later, years later, I mean, I found out more about him. And as abusive as my father was, he was
right.
just a slightly lesser version than what he knew than what his father was. Not
right.
that justifies it, but
no,
it made me
but it
understand
explains
him
it.
A little bit better. Yeah,
yeah.
It does explain it.
Wow, that's incredible. You know, the fact that you even came into that zone of understanding that is incredible. Did you come into that into your own flourishing, or did that take time of psychotherapy like the rest of us? Or,
well, I you know, a lot of reading. It's like books were popping off the shelf to me.
Right.
But I did go to therapy, and I had a wonderful therapist. And I had been, you know, the arts, the acting has
right.
really saved my life. I had been working on a play called The Dreamer Examined His Pillow, and that had me really go inside. I had written out my life because of that play and really took a look at myself and saw things that if I really didn't want to become my father, I had to take out of my life. And alcohol
right.
was the first thing at that time.
Hmm.
But my father, you were asking me about as a child and at the bar.
Oh.
I was the oldest of five. So I was he called me his number one son. Right? He's got another son, Michael. And on Saturdays, he would go to the Brentway bar, and he would take me with him. And it was like, oh, no, I don't want to spend time with him alone because he gets drunk. And that's going to affect how we treat
how he thinks. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, he would take me there before the bar opened and leave me at the bar with a Coke and a cherry in it and a quarter so I could play one ping pong, pinball game. And
right.
then he would go in the back room and be with the barmaid, Jean.
Right.
You know, and it was very confusing to me. I would hear things, noises from them, and not understand it at the time.
At the time,
and
yeah.
then, yeah, because I was only five at the time. I had just started kindergarten, and I remember driving home with him. And
wait, hold on a second. You were in kindergarten at this time?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so it's my earliest memories with him. And
wow.
he would tell me, you know, screw everything except family. I was like, all right, well, not really sure what that means, Dad. And he told me, if you say anything to your mother about Jeannie, I'll kill you. And so,
really?
Okay. Yeah.
At that age, kindergarten age, impression age.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And he'd be drunk. He loved his scotch. And he'd be drunk. And it wasn't till later when I started acting I had an affinity for Vietnam vets and prisoners of war, and I did plays about them. I didn't realize till later it's I identified with them. I felt like a prisoner of war in my own home.
Right.
I really felt
right.
at any time, you know, I got
absolutely
tortured and at any time I could be taken out.
Right, that is the number one influence for PTSD right there, is a consistent influence of trauma.
Yeah.
Wow. And you found the ability to forgive him in your lifetime. That's incredible.
But many years, it wasn't even when he was sick and passing away. It took years. You know, it cost you so much emotionally to hold on to that hate.
Yeah.
Or,
that,
you know,
that poison.
And, yeah. Yeah. And that you know, maybe it sounds cliche, but to forgive them really sets you free. And then I see that in a much bigger picture. You need to understand why somebody does what they do. You know, it's
right.
easy to just demonize somebody.
Right. Do you feel like the trek that... No, go ahead, please, continue.
No, I was just going to say, you know, one of the things I've been able to... you know, I had it very black and white in my mind for many years. My mother was good, my father was bad,
right.
Or evil. But, you know, I'm lucky through doing my one-man show, I have these discoveries on stage, and, you know, my sense of humor I got from my father. There were positive qualities that I can see now that I got from him. It wasn't all negative,
right.
like I had painted it in my head for so many years.
Right. I think it's important. Personally, I think it's very important to position things as traumatic and horrible, and then from that position to work itself backwards. I think it was important for you to hate the man in order to forgive the man, is what I was trying to say.
I agree.
Yeah.
To not recognize the damage it had done to me, to not take that in. I had to get
right.
in touch with it to work my way out of it.
Right. Or else I'll be honest, you probably would be stuck in some kind of masculine trap of destruction for the rest of your life.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, what accelerated, I think, my growth, what saved me from myself was becoming a father.
Hmm. Matty was a huge
yeah.
part of your life. No, he was a gigantic
yeah.
part of your existence, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. He, you know, well, it took, I can never get that depressed again. It for me, it took that option off the table. When
really?
I had a kid.
That's
yeah.
wonderful.
It's like, yeah, this like, you know, it's like, I'm going to have to deal with my depression differently. Yeah.
You say you're not a practicing Catholic, but you're doing all the Catholic things. That's funny to me.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, he had just really
yeah.
brought me gifts. And it's I had believed that the soul picks the parents that's going to provide what they need to learn in this life. That's what I
right.
believe. So I questioned that.
That's
I
think, nice.
Okay, I must have picked my mother and father because I had things to learn. So then I felt that was true of Matthew as well. He had picked us because I was going through a divorce when we got pregnant. We were going to get divorced.
Really?
And, yeah. So I said to my wife then that I will be father, but I'm not going to stay in the marriage. And she taught school, and about 6 months after he was born, I moved out, and she had the medical benefits.
Anthony would have gotten married and would have gotten their divorce around 6 years later. Now we both know that, right?
That mistake. Yeah, I lived through that mistake. That's all.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, I knew
right.
that was going to be. I lived through that. There was no way. I thought that would have been ingredients for me to become my father, probably. To
right.
be in a situation where I'm resentful.
You didn't want to be in?
Because I'm stuck.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm stuck in a relationship I don't want to be in.
Smart choice.
You know? And I didn't know I could be so selfless because all I ever wanted to do was act. And I was... $65,000 in debt from all the plays that I had put up. I had put up 90 plays and lost money on 89 plays up until that point. So I knew I couldn't be running to auditions and losing jobs. And because I had such a, well, my father was a good example of what not to do.
Right.
And so I would pick my son up every morning at 6. I'd have him till 4:30. And in the beginning, I had him on the weekends, too, and then we switched every other weekend, and I would have him one day during the week. So it was very lean times, and that's when I started teaching acting more at night and to leave me free to be with Matthew during the day.
Now, what did teaching acting help you in your acting ability?
Well, I believe there's a book that I love called Illusions by Richard Bach. And
great book.
One of the things he says in there, yeah, I love it. And he says, we teach best what we need to learn most ourselves. So I found that, you know, it allowed me to be around acting all the time. I was reinforcing these principles that I believed in.
Right.
You know, I started teaching by accident. I just wanted to have a group of actors to work together kind of in the format of the actor studio. And then, so I formed this group. I called it the Artist Theater Group. And then not long into it, one of my friends said, Tony, you've got to teach it. You know, it's too chaotic like this. Everybody's giving their opinion. And I said, well, I don't want to teach. I didn't want to teach because I love Woody Allen. And I remember Woody Allen said, I think, in Annie Hall, that those who do, those who can't do teach, and those who can't do anything teach Jim. So,
you know,
I thought if I wear the hat of teacher, it means I'm not an actor anymore. but that's another lesson I've learned, that you should not let others put limitations on ourselves, and definitely don't do it to yourself, that we're capable of wearing more than one hat.
I keep on laughing because my favorite quote from him is, don't knock masturbation, it's sex with somebody I love. He's quite a witty son of a gun. You know, you have a very new, East Coast sensibility about yourself. Is there a reason why we're ingratiated with you on the West Coast so much, and the East Coast, not so much?
I don't know. I think there's, from my point of view, from my experience, living on the East Coast, you see life happening around you. You know, you see time going by because of the change of the seasons. You come out to California, it was like the long, hot summer. But
right.
Also, there was a different work ethic, that I embraced, especially in acting. It was all about studying and working hard and learning your craft and being the best you can do and always being in the gym, by being in a class.
Right.
When I came to California, there was more emphasis on making connections and doing some quick on-camera
exchanges. Yeah,
and instead of really learning and falling in love with the craft of acting. So, I don't know. I mean, New York has a lot of, people from other places, but it just feels like one big community. LA,
right.
It seems like people are here for a little bit and on to somewhere else.
Yeah, it's very nomadic. It's very nomadic by nature, is what I've always said. Do you think that's why in LA? Now, I do not know the rate of suicide or harm done in New York is, but I do know in LA that we have quite a high rate of homelessness, mental illness. We have a high rate of all these things leading into Hollywood as well. Do you think that LA is one of those gravitas, one of those graviated cities that people come to no matter what because they want a dream to come true?
Yeah, I think it is like that painting, the Boulevard of Broken Dreams, for a lot of people.
Right.
Acting, this choice, this life choice, it's not like if you go to school and you're the best doctor, you're going to get out and you're going to find a job. I've seen some of the best acting that most people will never see because it becomes too difficult and they give it up along the way, or they just never got that opportunity.
Well, you've seen students. I mean, you've been a teacher for a long time. You've seen students with just the most incredible potential. They never made anything of themselves. Mm-hmm. And the people who had very little potential that became great things. What do you think? What do you think it takes along the way? What do you think it takes for people to succeed, at least succeed in this industry?
I think you've got to, for one, I think it's it can't be a passing fancy. It's got to be I need to do this. I love to do this. And then to be persistent and to be constantly working at your craft. And I think that everyone will get their shot, at least one. The only thing you have any control over is being ready when that opportunity comes. You know, if you haven't been working at it, you know, in the same way you built your confidence, like when you go to the gym, you're building muscle memory. When you're working at your craft, you're building emotional memory. So you want to be in shape when that opportunity comes. You don't want to be, oh my God, I haven't done it in a while. And, you know, and also that can't be everything. You have to find a way to survive out here. That has to be number one. Mm-hmm. You have to find a way to survive, because it can't be, I'm going on an audition. It's not just, I'd like to get it. I need to get it. I can't pay my rent. Because that's going to add a different kind of pressure. They're going to see it, and it's going to have nothing to do with the character that you're supposed to be becoming in that audition, because you're distracted by other things.
Right.
Mainly surviving.
You know, let's backtrack. Go ahead.
You're good.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I am seeing, though, now more people that I've worked with than ever before getting work. I guess it's because of all the different streaming services. But people that I've worked with, and not just getting parts, they're getting like lead parts on things.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
There's way more opportunities for them now. They have Hulu Plus, they have Disney Plus, they have Netflix. I mean, there's Amazon Prime. There are so many streaming networks right now. There's Apple TV now. I mean, there are so many great opportunities.
So there are opportunities to work, and so they should come out here and work at their craft. But also, you know, I'm a big advocate, and one of the things I teach in my classes is that you have to be a self-starter, that you have to take control of your career, and it's not good enough to just be the actor. You have to write, produce, direct, act. You got to create your own content.
Would you agree that goes along with your mental health as well? That while you're in this industry and while you're pushing yourself as hard as you can, that your mental health is also your responsibility, and you have to keep your eye on it?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, it keeps you, you know, it keeps you feeling like you're a part of this if you're working on your own material. You know, you have to find your film gang or your people of like mind to just begin creating with. You know, I have a student that when she had to go back to Australia, she had studied with me, and I had seen a director in her and producer, and she started directing here. When she went back to Sydney, she started a smartphone film festival, and now it's one of the biggest festivals. They'll be going into their sixth year next year. And so now as I teach around the world and here, I tell my students, take your phone out of your pocket, learn how to use it, and start making movies.
Yeah.
So there's no reason to not working at this, if this is what you want to do. And you have more opportunities. I mean, you know, when I started out, there were no crowdfunding platforms where you could try
YouTube,
to raise money. There was no
Netflix.
YouTube.
There's no YouTube. Yeah, no Instagram. No, none of that junk.
No.
I told that actor in a festival once. He asked me a question, and I couldn't help but be frustrated by going, come on, man. I mean, there's so many sources you have to make something that you want to make that right now the excuses are going to be yours.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
and I had a lot of students.
Go ahead.
I have a lot of students that they kind of wear this as a badge of honor. And I start when I first meet people, and I said, how many out there are perfectionists? And I'll see like three or four hands go up. I said, really? I said, that's another name for procrastinator.
Right.
Right. I know so many perfectionists, and it's like I can never do it because it's not going to be perfect.
Right.
And
art is not finished; it's abandoned. Is the old quote by a lot of great artists. Go ahead.
Yeah, and it sounds very noble. I'm a perfectionist. Sounds like it's a good thing, and
I
equate it with being a procrastinator. You know.
Yeah. So. It's like I have an excuse. I'm being a perfectionist. No, you don't know how to let go.
Yeah.
You know, as a writer
yeah.
myself, you know, you have to know when to just let go. That's good enough. And by the way, the more you work on it, the more you're going to ruin it.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah. That's interesting about art. You know, I found one of your stories incredibly fascinating. I mean, it's always stuck in my mind about Out of Darkness into the Light. But when you talked about your girlfriend that you met when you were younger, who is also a prostitute. She was a stripper, excuse me. And
right.
the reason why it stuck so firmly in my mind was that it was relatable in a way that men feel about shame on how they act sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
On how we feel, like we're almost ashamed on how we feel about situations, how we should be more mature. Does that make
mm-hmm.
sense to you?
Yeah, well, I think for myself and most men I know, they stayed boys for way too long.
Yeah.
It was such
a wonderful story that, you know, definitely makes me feel that, you know, I have felt very shameful about the way I've behaved towards certain people and the way I've judged their own behavior. And my behavior was
mm-hmm.
equally as horrible.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of how I saw that story, and it was very wonderful what you would see is a rustic East Coast man standing up there telling a very sensual and a very charismatic and a very up to beat story of how they felt about a situation. Very honest. It's very shocking to hear people speak that way.
Well, I write and that story comes up. And I had written a one-man play. I wrote a full-length play and a screenplay that I hope to make one day. And I called it The Dancer and the Savior. And
yeah.
I think that's how I saw the relationship. Like I didn't have much self-worth, right?
Hmm.
When I met Candy,
right.
You know, I was being trained to be a painter. And we would stop at the Lemon Tree. It was this topless bar. And I'd see her, and I just thought she was gorgeous, and I just started talking to her. And I asked her out, and I didn't have much money, and she agreed to go out with me. And I didn't have a car, so she agreed to pick me up. And we had spent the night together, and being my father's son, I mean, that was the only thing, as I got older, as I became a man. From the time I went in the Navy at 17.
Hmm.
We didn't really talk about anything. You know, in order for me to prove myself to him, it would be about how many women had I been with. So the fact that I had been with this stripper, it was like, I saw it as like a medal I won. You know, I told my father
right.
went down, he saw it and was like, yeah, that's my son. My son's been with her. But I continued, and my friends went and saw her, and was like, hey, right on, Anthony, great job. And meanwhile, I continued to go out with her, and I asked her, I started having feelings for her. And what she did was different in my head to who she was. And she was very much with her family. She wasn't like a lot of the girls that worked there. She didn't drink. She didn't do drugs. She spent a lot of her money on her family that she made. And I asked her one day, I says, why do you do what you do? Why do you dance? And then she told me that she had been married and her husband was older than her. He was a Vietnam vet.
Yeah.
And she was very much in love. And one Christmas they were coming home from shopping. She had bought some stuff in the apartment. He was still at the car coming in. And then she heard a car skid, a thump, and a car horn. And she ran out. A drunk driver had come up on the lawn and had hit him. And she ran out to him. And he died in her arms. And then that night she tried to kill herself.
Right.
And no, I'm sorry, it wasn't that night. It was after his funeral she tried to kill herself. And then she went into a hospital for 28 days. When she came out, she wanted to be close to him, so she went and lived with his sister, who was a stripper, and the rest is history. And then she started. She didn't really care. She hadn't dated anybody.
You know what this sounds like? It literally sounds like Waterloo Bridge. Have you ever seen that film, Waterloo Bridge,
no.
with Bob Roberts and Vivian Leigh? It is heartbreaking to hear this story of what came to be. And afterwards, she became a stripper, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, and she had been doing it for years. And I don't know why she agreed to go out with me. I mean, I think I was funny.
Charming. You're charming.
Yeah, thank you.
You're charming, thank man. You. Come on.
Yeah. So we had, and we were in the relationship for 2 years. And the first year, I called it the dance and a savior, right? I didn't have much self-worth. So I thought if I could save her from dancing, it would make me more worthy as a human being.
Let me ask you a question.
I don't really as I look back at it.
Do you? But in retrospect, you know, 2020 is hindsight, right? And, you know, in retrospect, do you think you had it worse than her? Because she seemed to have a plan somehow, and you seemed to be like swinging wildly.
Oh yes, yeah, no. She was in much better shape mentally. I mean, she was making her own choices. She knew what she was doing.
Right.
Was able to take care of her family. She enjoyed the ability to be able to do that. And there's a power to what those girls do, and I think she enjoyed
right.
that power, too.
Yeah.
So for the first year, money was going to be tight, and we ended up moving in together, and I said, I won't be able, I'm not going to be able to be in a relationship with you if you're going to continue this. And she said, I quit. And she had enough money in the bank. She paid off her credit card. She bought a brand new Lincoln Continental. And I was working two jobs, and I stopped going to HB Studios because we needed the money.
Mm-hmm.
And it was nice. We played house for that first year. But
yeah.
Then her younger sister got married, and I was always worried that if money got tight, you know, maybe she would sneak back into it, you know. And I was also embarrassed now that I had my father and all my friends here, and now I'm in love with her.
Yeah.
She's my girlfriend, so I didn't want to
yep.
see anybody. So now,
yep.
I was drinking. I was getting jealous. I was thinking, now everybody's looking at her, thinking of her naked. And,
right.
It wasn't a good time. And towards the second year, she was talking about getting married and she wanted to have kids. And I thought, there was part of me that could never accept what she had done. I didn't have the tools. I wasn't mature enough to be able to let that go, to be in the moment. I regret the way I behaved and the way I thought. And then the second year I started going back into acting. She got a job at the A&P, which was a supermarket.
Right.
And then I think when she felt me pulling away, I was definitely pulling away, and I was drinking more because I was unhappy. She did
really?
Move back into dancing. And
wow.
I had stopped by the same place I had met her with some friends that after work. And one of my friends says, hey, Tony, isn't that Candy up there? And I turned around, and the rest of it was like a Scorsese
wow.
film.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, you put a little bit of inside that your movie as well. You know, you have a clip of a man who loses his gall inside of a strip club as well. You just lost your mind, huh? And what did she do?
Oh, yeah. Well, I went over to her and I said, what are you doing up there? I said it with more colorful language.
Right.
And she said, "Oh, Tony, I'm sorry." And then I said, "I was going to marry you." And then it was actually during lunch. There was a lot of construction workers there. And one guy said, "Hey, guy, leave it alone." I said, "Shut up. I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to you." And then he pushed me, and then we got into a fight.
Wow.
And then my friends and those guys were fighting.
No.
And then they called the cops. Yeah, they called the cops. And the cops took me outside, and I was crying. I was trying to explain this to my girlfriend. They said, "Listen, you got to go home." I'm surprised because I was drunk.
Right.
"Let me get back in my car."
I don't blame you.
"Go home or we got to lock you up." Yeah, yeah. "We got to lock you up." So they followed me on Sunrise Highway for a little bit. And then they got a call, so they took off. And I was out of my mind. I did a U-turn into the oncoming traffic on, it would be like the 101, but it's Sunrise Highway. And it was only for a couple of miles, and I went right back to the bar. And when I went in, she was gone, and
jeez.
I didn't see the construction worker, but he saw me, and he nailed me, and we started fighting again.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you walk back in the bar, the guy blindsides you, and she disappears.
Yeah.
So how does this? I mean, that is you can definitely see where you slipped up on that one, and where it's just just so complicated. Wow. So what happened at the very? What happened at the end? How did you guys resolve this situation?
So the end. I go home. My friend drops me. I leave my car there. My friend drops me off, and she had a fascination with Marilyn Monroe. So we had one wall that just had Marilyn Monroe pictures. And I just continued to drown in my sorrow and drink whatever I had. And I tried calling her, and she was at her mother's. They said she don't want to talk to you. And then I was out of my mind. And I saw one of the Marilyn Monroe pictures smiling. I said, "Well, you're laughing at me?" And it felt good to break something. So I punched one and broke a bunch, so it was very dramatic.
Wow. Yeah.
So a lot
you
of
you are a writer.
A lot of broken glass. And then eventually they had gotten a hold of my friend Charlie and said, "She's not coming home."
Wow.
You know, and then I moved out, and that was the last time I saw her until 11 years later. Driving. I'm living in LA now, and I'm driving with my friend Charlie again, and we go past another place called the Dollhouse. And I say, "Charlie, doesn't that look like Candy's car?" And he goes, "Tony, please don't." I said, "I just want to see her." I said, "If you
wait, hold on a second.
Unhappy,
she was in California."
No. I was in New York. I was visiting New York.
Okay.
Was living in California, and then I was visiting New York.
Okay.
And he says, "All right, but let's just leave if it doesn't go good." And we walked in, and she was on the stage dancing, and it was like time had stopped. She looked the same, and she saw me right away. And I pointed to the door, like, "Should I leave?" And then she shook her head, "No." And then we talked, and it was nice. And Charlie left us alone. I apologized to her, and she told me that she had been with a guy, and, you know, they wanted to have a kid, and she couldn't have kids.
Oh.
She had an IUD, and something had happened, and now she wasn't able to have kids. So I felt so bad for her. She had the love of her life taken from her through a drunk driving accident, and now this other thing that she wanted so badly in life was to be a mom, and she couldn't have kids. I mean, she could adopt,
that's horrible.
But she couldn't have kids. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you asked me earlier who had it rougher. I don't know now. As I relay this to you, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like a very complicated situation. Did you accept your apology?
Yeah, she did, and it was nice to see her. We didn't really talk. We didn't blame on each other on, you know, whose fault what was, and
right.
You know, I told her I apologize really for my immaturity and, you know, the way I behaved.
Yeah. Well, I love that story. You know, just not a lot of grown men, and I'm talking about men, not boys, but grown men have the ability to articulate stories quite like that. You know, where I can definitely, and I think a lot of our audience here can definitely feel compassion for the situation, knowing that we've all been through a situation where we've judged improperly. And this situation could be way more complicated when we look back at it.
Absolutely. And the screenplay and the play that I wrote, I didn't include when we saw each other 11 years later. And so it was, I hadn't learned anything from it. So the movie and the play begin the same way. Me at a strip club, given the same stupid line.
Oh, really?
Dancer. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't want to tie it up in a nice bow, because it took me a long time to grow up, a long time to learn my lessons. And I think that's true for a lot of us, a lot of men. And it's not a film, I think, a lot of people, it's kind of like a Leaving Las Vegas, I think, in tone.
Right.
It's just doesn't get happy. I mean, there's funny moments in it, for sure, but it's not a tale of redemption.
No, it's not.
I
yeah,
even
it's
learned
not,
anything.
Yeah, I mean, you know, yeah, Leaving Las Vegas was meant to be one of those films that leaves an impact. It doesn't make you feel like, you know, you found necessarily a resolution to the situation, even though it does sound like you have found a resolution to the situation, which is really nice to have.
Yeah, but it was time and you know, really doing work on myself. You know, change isn't going to happen magically. I mean, with anything, you know, if you don't like your situation, if you don't like who you've become. You know, I know so many people that their thing is, well, this is the way I am. And I think there's a mindset that this is the way I am, right?
Yeah.
That we're in
like Popeye,
full of change.
Yeah.
You know?
This is who I am. This is
like
what I am. I'm going to be this way forever.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, ooh, really? Okay. Good luck.
You'll never survive, man. You'd be like that butterfly that gets burnt up by that one tree. You know, let's change gears a little bit. You're a huge Al Pacino fan. I'm not going to ask you where did that come from, because we're all Al Pacino fans. We love Al Pacino. But how much influence does that have in your teaching, in your writing of your books, in your making of plays, in your making of movies, in your directing, your writing? How much influence do you, the people that you, that like Woody Allen, that inspire you, have to do with your art?
Well, I think it's good for us, or I know it was good for me, to have a role model, to have an example of someone else that you can identify with doing it, and it makes it seem possible for you. You know, so Pacino was a Italian, born in the Bronx, close to his grandparents. Didn't have a relationship with his father. There were a lot that I identified with him as a man. And then I loved his work, so then I wanted to know what he knew. So I went to HB Studios because I heard he went there. I eventually studied Strasbourg with his friend and coach, Charlie Lawton, because I wanted to know what he knew. In the very beginning, I made the mistake of when I was taking classes, I was trying to be Pacino. I was trying to do it.
Oh, trying to emulate him, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And it wasn't until I had a good teacher, Michael Beckett, that said, listen, there already is a Pacino. You know, you got to find what's unique about you.
Yeah, right. No doubt.
Yeah. So, and I love how he bounces between television, film, and the stage, especially the stage.
Right.
And how his importance on doing the work. I mean, he was, he may still be the president of the Actor Studio. On any given day, you might find him moderating there. I mean, he loves it. He's like the Van Gogh of actors, you know, needs it to breathe. And I found that true of myself. You know, I have to be doing something for my acting every day. So it he was the example, and I feel like I picked up the baton from him. I love stage. I love being on stage. I love studying acting. I love watching acting. I love talking about acting.
Now, for a lot of our audience, you know, even though a lot of them are actors and writers and what have you, I'm just supposing, but for those who are not, that would be incredibly frightening to go on the stage. What is it about the stage that excites you, that exhilarates you, that would make most people just want to run away?
Well, I think they go up in the self-conscious. I think for me, myself, I've always been a storyteller. I always like telling stories, and I always liked having an audience. I always like making people laugh, making people feel things. I always did. I mean, in school, I was the class clown. You know, my mother thought I was going to grow up to be a comedian because I did so love to entertain. But the way I work and the way I teach, it starts with the foundation in Meisner. But I've pulled from Meisner, Strasberg, Chekhov, Adler, and a lot of me, and for my own way of teaching the Montez method.
Right.
And there's five, but I'm adding a sixth principle to it, and three I got from Sandy to. Work moment to moment, to live truthfully, to not live in the past. Two I got from Charlie, don't attach yourself to the result, enjoy the journey, and then listen. And that's also everybody, Strasberg's mind, and it's all about listening. So these six principles are not only great for actors, they're great for us living life. To not live
so
in
this
the
is,
past. I lived in the past
so this
so
is the,
long,
this,
and it just
so this is the Montez method.
Yeah.
This sounds, like
the,
it
the
definitely sounds.
Kind of,
you said it helped you out in your life. It definitely sounds like a philosophy.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, these guys used it, you know, for acting, but it so affects our lives. Like I was saying, I living in the past had ruined my life. You know, I dragged my drama around with me. To live truthfully, you know, I've not in the past. I do so now. To live moment to moment, I try to stay in the present. To not attach myself to the result. When I came out here, I put off happiness for years, thinking once I make it, and make it meant, you know, making money and being famous as an actor. When I first began, I don't think that now. Once I make it, I can be happy. Well, I have years, I haven't made it, so I had years of just being miserable. I wasn't enjoying my journey.
Right.
And to listen, to be a good listener in our acting and in life. And I think these principles, you know, over the years, I've taught people who didn't even want to be actors. I've taught lawyers and therapists and doctors and dentist CEOs because they just wanted to have better communication skills.
Tell me you know, about your mother. You know, let's switch gears here. Tell me about your mom, because you know we didn't talk about your mom at all, and she's an incredible human being. She's definitely motivated you and been a great helper with Maddie's raising and what have you. Tell me a little bit about her.
Well, my mom and Matthew are the two best people I've ever met, and she is someone who practices what she preaches. She's selfless, not just with her family, with others. She's got a light that shines and people pick up on. She's for years, I think 28 years, she used to help feed the homeless through the church, and then she cooked for them for all but I think 5 years, and then those 5 years she would help feed the homeless and also drive food into Harlem to give to these French nuns to distribute.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and she just stopped that this year at 82. She still works. She's become, well, you know, I have such, you know, haven't put her, such regret, haven't put her through what I did with the train. I mean, now being a parent, I can't imagine what that was like. I can imagine what that was like. You know, so for a long time, in the beginning, I didn't tell anybody I jumped. I told people I slipped. And then when I finally admitted it, you know, I would hear when she'd say, "Everything okay?" a little bit more concern, you know, worried that if I didn't sound good, that maybe I would do something again, you know. So I'm sorry that I've put that on her. And she knows that. I mean, we have a great dialogue. She's become one of my best. She has a great story with her, with Pacino. When I wrote a short film called Seeing Pacino. I had sent it to my mother.
Before you go into that, did your mother ever see your play? Because I know that you were a little hesitant to want to show her your play.
She's seen everything except my one man show, and I didn't want her to see it because I didn't want to edit myself in the play, and I don't know what's going to come out, and I wanted to pull things out. You know, I think she suspects my father's infidelities. I don't want to be the one to confirm them. You know, if she asked me directly, I wouldn't lie to her. I would tell her. But I don't think I need to hurt her, you know.
Right.
There'd be no point, you know.
At this point.
You know, she loved my father. I don't want to be the one to ruin that, you know.
Yeah.
Unless, like I say, she asked me directly,
So she's a huge influence. She's a huge influence in your life.
Oh yeah, she's the better part of me.
Yeah.
You know, she's my sensitivity. She's my heart. She's my whatever. Good I've done has come from her. I mean, she's sitting on a lot of my classes. You know, she's prayed for a lot of my students with the holy water. She's a great believer in the faith without forcing it on anybody. She goes to church every day. She lives now right by the church. She could roll out of bed and she's in church. She's in the parking lot where her apartment is. But she had, I had written this piece, Seeing Pacino, so I had given it to her. So she said, "Anthony, I'm going to go." She was going with my sister to see Pacino on Broadway. "I'm going to see if I can give it to him." I said, "Okay, Ma." So she went, and they found out where Pacino would come out, so she stayed by the barrier. And then Pacino came out, and she goes, "Ow." "Ow." So Pacino goes over to my mother, and she said, "My son wrote this," and she handed it to him. So she calls me a few days later. She said, "Did Pacino call you?" I said, "No, Ma." And she put one of my headshots in it. I said, "No, Ma." I said, "He probably gets a lot of things like that." So years later, she had my script of Cleaners, and she was going to see another Pacino play with my sister.
Yeah.
So she does the same thing. She finds out where he's going to come out, and she goes, "Ow." And she gives the script. So last year Pacino was screening Salome at the same theater where they screened my films, which felt like I was getting closer to him on Fine Arts Theater. And my mom was in town at the time, and Matthew was here, and Pacino was showing Salome and then doing a Q&A. And he'd been doing Q&A about 20 minutes, and all of a sudden I see my mother's hand go up.
Oh my God!
And the coordinator stops Pacino before he gets to anyone. He goes, "I'm sorry, because there were other people too. We really got to stop. We've got to get out of here." So when we got out, I said, "Mom, what were you going to ask Pacino?" She said, "I was going to ask him. I gave you two scripts. Did you ever read them?" that my son wrote. He's right here.
That's funny. So that's the kind of mother she is. She's very much in your face, very much, you know, being your manager.
Yeah, and not in a stage
aggressive
way. She just thinks it makes sense.
She's
proud.
She's proud.
If she thinks the work is good, I think you should just read this, and maybe you and my son can work together. I so wish you would have gotten to ask the question. I would have been mortified at the moment. But
it'd be a great story for right now, I tell you that much.
Yeah, he might have been felt obligated to at least.
I know he might have. He might have been like, I didn't, yeah. But I'm going to look for them now. Send them again.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you're going to be that motivated, for Christ's sake, let's go.
Well, I'm sure the next time he's doing a Broadway play, you know, she'll be there with one of my scripts. So
go ahead. Let's go back just a tad bit. So you were for the New York Film Institute, did you not? You taught there.
Yeah, I taught there for 9 years.
Nice. No, so you've been teaching for a very long time. What do you like more? Do you like more expressing yourself out there in the acting field? Do you like more teaching, or is there like a mixture between the two?
It is probably a mixture because, you know, if you see any of my, I've taught in Paris and, you know, in 12 other countries. And if you Google my name, Anthony Montes, or even if you Google Sandy Mize's name, I come up in like about 4 or 5 feeds. And
oh, nice.
There's some examples of me teaching in Paris. And then I have on YouTube, the Montes Method is me talking about acting and students talking about me. But it's all kind of a, you know, it gives me a chance to get on stage and to do my thing. So I love teaching. I love acting. I'm really hungry to act right now.
Right.
I haven't gotten to do it in a while. You know, I was thinking about putting my one-man show back up in December, but I've got to figure that out financially.
Oh, that'd be nice.
All the money in, yeah. I put all the money in last time, and I can't do that again this time. So, but I know, especially around the holidays, when I know people become more depressed, I would love to do it then. And I did it in Frankfurt this summer, and I'll do it again next summer. So
how was the reception in Frankfurt?
Great. I mean, great. It was all an English-speaking audience. It was a small black box theater, and I did the same thing there that I do here. Afterwards, I do a Q&A, and people want to talk about their own stories, their own battles with depression, their own feelings of, you know, suicide, or maybe they have known someone who suffers. So people, it allows people to talk about this subject that's taboo, and I think it's through the talking about it is kind of healing.
Well, that was really my next question. Do you enjoy talking? Because it does seem, you know, when I hear a lot of the Q&As at your performances or what have you, is people are definitely, without a doubt, sharing their own personal experiences. Were you expecting that when you initially wrote this?
No. I was originally wanted to tell. I thought I had some interesting stories to tell.
Right.
Excuse me. When I was a kid, I always thought I was being watched. I always thought we were being filmed by God or whatever. So I would always do things a little extra so I would have good tape on myself at the end of my life. I would have a good movie.
Right.
And I wanted to tell these stories. But then as I started putting the stories together, I thought, ooh, well, it's not. What did surprise me then I knew it was a taboo subject. I wanted to put a face on what depression looked like, because anyone who knew me would never have ever have guessed that I had sunk so much into depression
so
that I tried to take my life. Yeah, no one would have. So I wanted to put a face on it and say, this is what it looks like.
Let me ask you a question.
I didn't know the response would be, yeah.
You didn't think the response would be people coming up to you and like telling you their entire life story?
No, I didn't know. And I'm glad they do, because I know they
really
they need to. Yeah. Yeah. I realized I was opening myself up to that. And I wanted to shed whatever experience or whatever I could on that subject and help relieve any pain if I could. by talking
about it. Did you find it cathartic?
I find it cathartic on stage sometimes because I have the beginning of the piece is written, the end of the piece is written, the middle is all these stories, but it's really, improvised.
Right.
I don't know what stories come up. The stories are all true, but sometimes as I'm saying a story, I'm having a revelation there right in front of everybody. And I share that moment. It's like, wow, as I'm saying this, I'm just realizing now. So, yeah, that is cathartic, the doing of it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's maybe know myself better, made me like myself better, maybe forgive myself easier.
Right.
But what did surprise me, too, is it's not just a story, I think, about this man falling into depression and taking his own life. It's also about change, that we can change if we want to, because I have changed so much from who I was from who I was told I was to who I found I am.
Right. If you can look back at that person, at that guy, I mean, pre-Matthew, let's just say pre-Matthew, not even jumping in front of the train. What would you tell that person that you've seen now that can somehow, I mean, we know how depression works. It's really hard to get through that really thick part of the wall that's holding in the depression. But is there anything you can tell yourself back then that can somehow break that fourth wall and bring him into fruition?
Maybe that what your father's telling you is not your truth. You are not what he says. Your father has problems, but that's not who he says you are, is not who you are. That you are lovable. You are loved. And I love you, kid.
Yeah.
That's what I tell him.
Wow. Yeah, that's powerful stuff, man. You know, your work is incredibly powerful. We're all ingratiated by it. And this interview went by really, really fast. So that's an hour and a half, pretty fast. How can we find you? How can we see you? How can we find you? How can we see your work?
Well, you can have a YouTube channel. It's just Montez Method on Instagram.
Okay.
You go to Montez Method. I have a website, The Montez Method. And if anyone has any questions, they can always email me at montezmethod@gmail.com.
So Montez Method is really what they want to go for right now.
Yeah, I mean that's what I'm. I'm having a great time teaching. I'm not at a point in my life where I can just drop everything and pursue an acting career. I think the acting work I'm going to do is either going to come through friends or my own projects. And I have 9 screenplays that I need to find the money for, and have more plays. And my one-man show is something I will continue to put up.
I hope so. It was really wonderful. Now, did Maddie get? I know you didn't want to definitely show it to your son, but did Matthew get a chance to see that play?
No. I don't think he wants to see it.
Right.
Not at this point.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's painful.
That was the toughest thing I had to do, because when I was doing this play, actually before that, when I was doing the film, I had a Kickstarter campaign where I was raising the money. I talked openly on my attempted suicide.
Right.
So Matthew was about 14 at the time, and I thought, "Shit, this is a subject I'm going to have to bring up to him."
Right.
There was no way. We have a very honest relationship, but there was, same like I told you, there's no reason for my mother through that. I would have told him after he was 18, but I didn't want him to worry as a kid. But I was afraid that somehow he might see something on the internet with me talking about it, that he has to hear it from me first. So I sat him down and I said, Matthew, I want to tell you, you know. And I told him that, you know, when I was 27, I was suffering from depression and I tried to take my life. And I told him how. And he listened and we cried together. And at the end of it, I said, what do you think about what I told you? He said, I'm disappointed, Dad. I said, okay, I understand. You're disappointed in what I did? He said, no. He said, I thought we have an honest relationship and we tell each other everything. I said, we do have an honest relationship and I don't want you to think I don't. I says, but if you could please just put yourself in my position. I would have told you when you were 18 and I wouldn't be telling you right now, but I'm afraid you might see it some other way. If you were me, when do you think would be a good age to tell your son this? He goes, you're right, Dad. And we hugged and that was it.
Well, that makes complete sense. You know, I mean, when do you tell your child?
Right.
Yeah. Well, has he showed any interest in the arts himself?
No, but when, you know, I had him all the time. So I started kid acting classes because I was going to have him. And then I wrote kids plays and he acted in them. And I think, you know, not too long ago, maybe 8 months ago, we would somebody and somebody assumed because he's my son that he's going to be an actor and said, so Matthew, you're an actor too? And he said, no. And he said it really quick. And Matthew is, he studies, he's studying at UC Santa Cruz, environmental science. So I said to him later, I said, you answered really quick. No, and you asked if you could be an actor. Do you think there's something wrong with that? He says, no, Dad. He goes, but that's your thing. And
right.
I think even if it was something that he loved, he sees that as my thing, that's my area.
Right.
That, you know, and all I've ever wanted for him is to just be happy, just find whatever makes you happy and pursue that.
If you want anything for your grandparents who basically help bring you up, if you want them to think anything of you, what would that be?
That was a good person.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was that a hard thing for you to like come into flourishing for yourself? Because I know you had a very, you know, we talked a lot today and, I know it became very difficult for you to get to that point. Did it come to a certain head to you to know that you are a good person?
It came, I alluded to it a little bit when I was working on John Patrick Shanley's play, The Dreamer Examines His Pillow.
Yes.
In it, the character's trying to take what he's feeling inside and put it on the canvas so he can look at himself and only put back what he wants. So I got canvas, paints, brushes, started painting, and I wasn't getting the same thing. I was 37 and a half. So I started writing. I was born March 11, 1956. I was in therapy at the time, and I would bring the pages to my therapist, right?
Mm-hmm.
And for 6 weeks, I wrote 203 pages, single space, and she read it all.
Jeez.
But I was hoping by giving it to her, she would say, oh, Anthony, here's your problem on page 37. You know, just rip this page out of your life and you'd be good to go.
Right.
And I read it once. And our life really reads like a book. I mean, things I didn't like about myself, things I felt guilty about. When I got to that part in my life, I realized that what I did was the best that I could do with the tools that I had. I've been judging myself by what I know now. I didn't know that at that time. So everything I did was the best I could do with what I knew at that time. And it was the first time I liked myself. I felt sorry for this kid. And I would recommend it to everyone. It was the best therapy I ever did. It was 203 pages. I wasn't kind to myself. I went to Zuma Beach. I was 37 and a half. I drew a line in the sand. I screamed out over the ocean. I don't take any responsibility for anything I've ever done in my life. It's all my father's fault. And I stepped over that line, and I said, everything I do from today forward, I do. I own it.
Right.
And that was a monumental change in my thinking, in my approach to life. And at that time, I thought, because I was still suffering from depression, I didn't think I had a drinking problem. I thought I had a depression problem, but I thought alcohol wasn't helping. So I stopped drinking for 14 and a half years.
Nice.
Just like that on my own. I just stopped.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's awesome. You know, let's go to one question before we take off, because we're going to take off very soon. But,
okay.
You know, if what somebody's asking right now is, if they're coming from a small town, what would you do? What kind of, let me see the question again. Well, they want to know what they should work on as an actor, what field they should work on. Strasburg, Meisner. What do you think? What do you think they should work on right now while they're still in their town?
Well, I think there's so many videos on Meisner, Strasburg, Adler, and my videos, the Montez method, that you should
right.
watch them and see which method, which way of working speaks to you.
Right.
You know, because they're different. They're all going for the same thing. They're going for to be emotionally truthful. I would look at the actors that they like, read and watch videos on them. There's a great series called Actors on Actors inside the Actor Studio. There's so much.
Oh yeah, with Don Lemon.
Yeah. So there's a lot of things that they can watch. I'm going to have by the end of this, maybe by the end of next month, I'm going to have an online class, actually.
Oh, really?
Sierra and I put together. Yeah. So we put together the beginning series. So if they want
what's
to
that, what's,
email
what's that
going to
be?
And
give us your email address.
It's MontezMethod@gmail.com. And then
oh, great.
Once it launches, I'll be able to direct them to the place. But there'll be exercises that I give that they're able to do at home. And
nice.
The whole beginning series. Yeah.
So those are incredibly popular. And, you know, this is absolutely the world of the face camera learning process, like YouTube and Hulu and what have you. There's so many people who've learned such incredible processes through these episodes. Is that why you're going towards this field?
Yeah, and for people just like your guests that aren't in the big cities, that have a passion for it and don't know where to look, so that they can start to learn the same things that I'm teaching here and overseas, you know, and it gives them a little taste of what it's like to be an actor
right.
before they make a move to a bigger city. You know, or if they really like it, then they pull if there's tutorials on how to use your phone. I'm sure there's online classes on how to use your phone as a camera and start making
sure.
your own movies. But
sure,
you know, but first learn your craft and learn some acting techniques.
Yeah, if you want to be an actor, learn your craft. So we all know it's Montez Method. Instagram. Do you have a Twitter page too?
No, I don't have a month this month.
Get yourself a Twitter.
Page.
So yeah. Facebook.
I will.
So we know how to get Anthony in there. So, Anthony, thank you so much for being with us today. You've been an incredible guest. And to be honest like this as a guest is the best thing. And thank you so much for sharing your information with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Anthony. All right, guys, we're going to be going on to a break. We'll talk soon. Well, you don't need to hear that song. I was actually going to call it Anthony. If you hear this interview afterwards, I was going to talk to you off camera real fast or off radio, but you hung up. But thank you so much for being with us today, Anthony. I greatly appreciate it. My audience does not need to hear that song once more again. Now, that was a fantastic interview. Would you not agree? Anthony Montez did a great job. He told us about his past, his present, basically gave you half of his play on a radio interview. So what did you learn today? Learn a thing about depression? You learn a thing about acting? You learn a thing about being honest as a human being? How to be a good actor? How to be a good man? I do want to put this out there, as morbid as it may be, but it needs to be said. If you do have suicidal thoughts, or you do want suicidal prevention, you can call 1-800-273-8255. Again, it's 1-800-273-8255. There have been plenty of time where I didn't want to be on this earth. Just like the Futurama episode where he says, I don't want to be on this planet anymore, gets on a rocket ship and takes off. So what did you learn from Anthony? Work hard. Work on your craft. Work on yourself. Be a better person. Incredible little process. You're talking about somebody who charges you for these lessons, these little lessons. That you'll ask questions like this all the time, and you got it for free today, guys. You should be thankful. Well, bless you all. Thank you all for listening in. I am Steve Pisa for Cinema Files Radio. I appreciate you all being here today. I hope you have a glorious, glorious Sunday. A wonderful day. I will end with this. The only way for evil to exist is for good people to stand by and do nothing. It's one of my favorite quotes in the entire planet Earth. Bless you all. See you next week.